Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and boy, oh boy, tonight's Paradigm Shifter has really shifted huge paradigms in the medical community. You're a doctor yourself, Dr. Bernie Siegel. Welcome to Paradigm Shifters.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and I remember I told you the last time we talked, which was quite a long time ago, that when my husband had a brain hemorrhage, your book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, had just come out, and it really made a huge difference. Mm. But the art of healing, I'm really touched by it. You're just constantly unfolding, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we all keep learning, really. I mean, the thing
if we're lucky,
that
yeah.
I try to do is not repeat things, because I've said in some of my previous books that I don't have anything new to say, but it's updated, if you know what I mean.
I do, yeah.
You know, it's like if you handed somebody the Bible and you handed them, you know, a modern psychology book, they might find it a lot easier to get the same messages out of the psychology book as the Bible, you know, if it's talking in parables and other things. And so I try to keep, number one, yes, repeating themes that I learned have worked, but in a way that people can apply it easily today. And number two, when I discover new things that I want to wake the world up to also, like, you know, how dreams and drawings can communicate information about your health and the body and everything else, and things that doctors aren't taught. You know, we get so broken up. I always get back to the electrician and the plumber. You know what I mean? That you have a house.
Right.
But you need various people to come and repair it.
Right.
And I think too often doctors look at the body like a house. Mm. So that's my specialty. You know, I don't know about the rest of the body or the rest of the house. But, you know, when you're dealing with a human being, it's not like a house. I mean, you have to know the whole person. The house doesn't have emotions and feelings, you know, and problems, but people do. And so you need to know the whole person. And often when I thought I was discovering things as a doctor, I mean it literally, I sent articles to journals. The medical journals sent them back saying it's interesting, but it's not appropriate. The appropriate journals sent it back saying it's appropriate, but it's not interesting.
Isn't that funny?
And I thought, this is incredible that I go through an education, so-called education, mm-hmm. and all I got was information. I really wasn't educated. Mm-hmm. I had to discover these things. And so I try to live by my experience. That's the way I put it to people, because, you know, you get used to people saying to you, oh, I can't accept that. Mm-hmm. I say, what do you mean you can't accept it? I'm telling you a true story. Well, I can't accept it. I said, why don't you just say I can't understand it, or I can't explain it, or I don't know how it happened?
Well, aren't we confined by our beliefs anyways? And
that's
I can't,
right.
Yeah.
And that's why I say, I live by my experience. If I experience something, I believe in it, even if I can't explain it. I always say, you know, we don't have an answer to how life began and the universe was created. So, you know, it's easier to talk to literally physicists and quantum, therapists and astronomers and so forth, because they're dealing with the unknown.
With the unknown, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, right at the beginning, there's something I was really interested in. This is a really good book, so it's not just that one part. But right at the beginning, you were talking about how there's kind of a contagion or a passing on of information through animals. What was it? What was the one you said that?
Communicating.
Yeah, and communicating awarenesses and communicating. Waking up or
because
growing.
I'm talking about consciousness not being local. Mm-hmm. So it speaks to us. I always say we go to sleep to get that information.
Right. I love
that. Like today, a lady sent me her dream about a house and, problems in the house. And she woke up said and emailed me, I don't know what it's about. I said, the house is you. You know, what's going on in your life that you need to fix? Mm. Because she talked about, the house needing repair and that she didn't feel comfortable in it. I mean, it's, again, she's talking about herself. You see, so, but if she isn't sleeping, she doesn't get that message.
And the way you talk about it, it isn't that complicated for people to get out of their thinking and touch into what the message is
it? Yeah, if I call it taking the lid off. I mean, mm-hmm. do guided imagery, do meditation, so your consciousness knows you're willing to, you know, be open to this information. And yeah, there are plenty of dreams that are, I always say, more like going to a movie. You know, they're nothing monumental, and you wake up and I don't, you know, if I remember them, fine. If I don't, it's okay. But then I've had other really significant dreams. When I wake up, I don't have to think about, do I remember it? Boy, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But let me, to get back to animals, the thing that totally convinced me of the non-locality of consciousness was a friend of mine. I met her at a conference in California, Amelia Kincaid, mm-hmm. and she travels around the world teaching people how to communicate with animals and has written several books. But I thought, it's nuts. You see, I had no experience with this, and when she said she's an animal intuitive, I couldn't believe it. I mean, that seemed crazy to me, all right?
Right.
You talk to animals, but one of our cats disappeared, and I'm in Connecticut. She's in Los Angeles. So I emailed her, you know, to challenge her. I said, okay, tell me where the cat is. Without even a photograph of the cat, which she had requested, mm-hmm. one evening I get an email. It says, the cat's alive. I can see the moon through her eyes. And what followed was a total description of the house, the veterinarian's first name. I mean, a million other odds and ends that were incredible. And the next morning, I just stood outside the house screaming the cat's name. Because what didn't make sense, she said, it's under the house. And I thought, I mean, what are you talking about? A cat's under the house. But there's a stairway coming off the house down a little hill. And the sides of the stairway go down to the ground. And the cat is squeezed in under it. Because she's an indoor cat who had gotten out when somebody left the door open. So, I mean, she didn't know what to do. So, in a sense, she put herself in this cage to protect herself from all the other animals and pets.
Aww.
And I heard her cry after I stood there screaming her name for 5 minutes. And then I pulled her out and, you know, got her in the house and saved her life. And recently, see, now I'm a believer, one of our cats disappears again. And I was sure it was in the basement, you know, because I had been working in the basement and left the door open for a minute. But no matter how many times I turned the light on and called the cat's name, she never came out. So I called Amelia, and Amelia described the basement all over again, because what I'm doing is cleaning out the house. We have 5 kids, and there are boxes and bags and things, you know, of stuff just piled up all around the basement. And Amelia said, is the cat in the garage? All I'm seeing is boxes and bags, and all the, and I knew she was describing the basement. But I go back, the cat isn't there. When I left the house, I was out of the house for 2 minutes, my wife and a friend heard the cat go, meow, and they went down, opened the door, and she ran out. And you see, because when I was trying to do what Amelia does, I was getting a blank. Mm. And I realized afterwards, the cat knows she's not supposed to have gone in the basement. She doesn't want me to know she's in the basement. So
she's sending you a blank message. Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, she came out, right. But see, the key in Amelia's message is, Bernie, quiet your mind.
Uh-huh.
Because if I can't find the dog, like I accidentally leave the car door open and go shopping, you come back, where's the dog? And I start screaming, I hear Amelia say, Bernie, quiet your mind, get in the animal's head. And then I know where the dog is, and I mean it. And the still pond, you see, the quiet mind is when you see the true reflection, whether you're an ugly duckling and know you're a swan, a tiger brought up by goats, realizes he's a tiger when another tiger takes him to a still pond. Uh-huh. And that, you see, gets back to, again, how do people do this? Quiet your mind.
Hmm.
You know, if you go to bed worrying what's going to happen tomorrow, or you say, oh, I'll meditate. Yeah, but if your meditation is, where are the kids? Am I going to be able to pay the bills this month? It never is going to work. But when you can quiet your mind, that's why things like a mantra, you know, a word that brings you peace and calms you. And that really works. Because mm-hmm. I know when I go out in the morning walking the dogs, if I've got a million things in my mind, I just repeat my word.
Mm-hmm.
And it refocuses me. Mm-hmm. Or even if I'm singing songs I just heard, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to spend the morning singing. I just pick up that word, put it in. It breaks the cycle, and then I'm back in a different place again. and you feel better.
Well, so tell me this, going back to the animal thing and your introduction, you were talking about how, this is a slight jump in subject, but I think you'll get what I mean. You were talking about how birds learn to peck into milk bottles that had been delivered.
Oh, yeah, that was, fascinating.
And what I'm interested in is how, it is, my question is this, do you experience that our consciousness is rising and that we're collectively changing? And so maybe you want to tell the bird story, but I'm just thinking that's maybe
well,
true.
The bird story was about World War II. Mm-hmm. Birds had learned somehow that they could peck their way into the milk cartons that were left at people's doors because the deliveries were made at your door, and people would come out and the birds had pecked a hole in the top and were drinking the milk.
And that's probably a milk bottle, right?
Well, I don't know if it was a bottle or a carton, whatever, but at least they pecked the top open and could reach in.
Right.
But the war comes, the milk deliveries are stopped for years, and the birds, their length of life was not enough to survive, you know, through that period of time. And then the war ends and the milk deliveries start again. And in, I don't remember, it was a few days, the birds were pecking holes and drinking the milk again. And it's, how does that information get passed on? Mm-hmm. And as I say, consciousness does not need a body to exist. And I think that if we all literally raise our level of consciousness, I call it similar to if we all become postgraduate students instead of kindergarten students, then the future will be a much better place to reside in, and the world will be a better place because we will have raised the level of consciousness.
And you're doing that with your exceptional cancer patient groups, which have grown all over the place, have they not?
Yeah. And I think that, again, it has physical benefits when those things happen. Mm-hmm. Because when you, again, get into this other state and begin to really appreciate and enjoy life, I always say, if I had to summarize, you're loving your life, you're loving your body. Mm-hmm. Then your body gets that message, and it does all it can to keep you alive. Mm. The Monday morning, it's a very simple example. We have more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. Mm-hmm. Why? Because people are miserable on Monday morning.
They don't want to go to work.
They don't want to work, traffic, you know, everything. And so those things happen. The body does not see death as the worst outcome. Mm-hmm. When you die, you leave your body and become perfect again. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had lots of experience with near-death, you know, experiences. Blind people see. You're able to think, even though I can't explain how, but the consciousness continues to exist even when the body doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I really feel, and even the description of what we call past life, I think, in other words, it's not you and I living other lives. It's you and I aware of other lives because the consciousness has come into us. Mm-hmm. And I feel very often that when you see some four-year-old go over and play a piano or sing as if they're an opera star. I mean, you know, an incredible voice. And you'd say, well, how does that kid do? I think the child has within it the consciousness of a piano player, say, or an opera singer, or they may fix your plumbing and say, okay, I got a plumber's consciousness. I mean, it can be all these things.
Or so all of the above, yes.
Yeah, so what profession you choose and a whole host of things can be affected by that. And I think the more we're aware of all these things, the healthier our future is.
That's right.
We understand ourselves.
And you've helped so many people reverse a really dangerous illness or a really difficult illness. And I just keep thinking, well, you know, you're passing it on to people that we have human potential. Human potential is a consciousness that's lifting.
That's the key word, right?
Yeah?
Potential. See, in other words, you don't die because of statistics. Mm-hmm. But if you're afraid to give it a challenge, then you have a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, if you're brought up without love, the opposite of love is indifference, rejection, and abuse. Mm-hmm. So you're brought up with indifference, rejection, and abuse, you feel like a failure. You're afraid to take on the challenge.
Right.
So You don't try for your potential, because what if I don't get it to happen? Then I failed again. Like my mother said, I'm a failure and I embarrassed her. But often, you see, when people get a life-threatening illness, then it's, well, what have I got to lose? You know, mm-hmm. And they wake up and start living. Hmm. See, Solzhenitsyn used a wonderful term in his book, Cancer Ward. Because, you see, you ask a doctor, what do you call it when somebody gets well and they're not supposed to? Mm-hmm. A spontaneous remission. But it isn't spontaneous, say, or miraculous. Hmm. Solzhenitsyn used the term self-induced healing.
Aha, I love that.
You know? Yeah, and the symbol for it, as he describes, it flutters out of the book, those words, like a rainbow-colored butterfly. Hmm. He knows what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The butterfly is a symbol of transformation. The rainbow is your life in order. Hmm. So how do you have it happen? You create a new life with order and harmony, one you can enjoy, one you love. And then your body says, oh, you're enjoying all this. Well, I'll keep you here as long as I can. I mean, I have one wonderful letter I often cite that a lady wrote me. She said, the doctor told me I had 2 months to live, and this time, she said, I agreed with him because I really felt awful. So I bought a dog. I put in a backyard wildlife habitat. I laughed more. I took some vitamins. The letter ends with, I didn't die, and now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Where do I go from here?
But tell me this, the thing I really am fascinated by in your work, because you really went uphill doing your work at the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, really investigating our human potential, if you will. Is it contagious? Are we evolving fast as a species? Is that a possible dream to enjoy for myself?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's too slow, because all the things I'd like, you know, why I keep writing these books and putting the pictures in, hoping to wake up the medical profession.
Yeah.
So we treat people differently and believe in the potential and don't kill them with words. See, we're not trained to talk to people. And people's beliefs have so much to do with how they respond to treatment, side effects and benefits. And that's another part I began to learn. I call it now deceiving people into health, because I would lie to people for their benefit.
You have a funny story about sending somebody to AA who wasn't an alcoholic.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, when I started doing this, people would get in touch with me. Is there a cancer, you know, an ECAP group, exceptional cancer patient group in my neighborhood? I said, no, we're just getting started. I said, but I'll tell you what to do. Go to an AA meeting, because you'll learn some of the same themes, you see. And then AA people got in touch with me saying, stop sending people here who are not alcoholics. They don't understand. You know, to me,
I think that's hilarious. I love it.
But I thought that was sad, too. You know, that they didn't say to these people, hey, you're welcome. You have cancer. Come on, if we can help you.
Right.
See, one of their lines is fake it till you make it. And that's a big part of it, mm-hmm. that you act as if you're the person you want to become. Mm-hmm. Because literally, when you're acting, because this is done with actors in a script, comedy, it enhances immune function, lowers stress hormone levels.
Right.
A tragedy lowers immune function, raises stress hormone levels. So, you know, what's going on in your life affects your chemistry, which affects your genes and your health. Loneliness affects the genes that control immune function. Laughter. You want to live longer? Laugh 5 or 6 times a day for no apparent reason. I mean, this was another study done with cancer patients.
Yeah.
And those who
remember
laughed
Norman,
longer,
what's his name?
Yeah, Norman Cousins.
Yeah.
Oh, he was an old friend way back when.
Well, he did a great job, just like you are,
right,
changing people's thinking about
that. But he was easier for doctors to accept, because they could belittle him. See,
because he was an editor.
Yeah,
as
they
well.
Could say, well, you know, maybe he didn't have it, and, you know, maybe it was his treatment, you know. But if I get up to talk, they had a lot of trouble, because it's another doctor. You know, what are we going to do with him? Yeah.
You're a real groundbreaker, Bernie.
But I learned to tell stories.
I know. You're a wonderful
because
storyteller.
Then you didn't argue. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because when I first began to speak to physicians, I tried to make it scientific presentation. And then they'd get to me with, it's not, you know, validity is not well controlled, and it's a poor journal that appeared in, so how do we know we can believe it? So I became a storyteller. Then like with Norman Cousins, they could walk out saying, that was an anecdote. That's a story. But it affected their outlook, you see, because then if a story came into their office, then they were happy to talk to me about it.
Uh-huh,
you know,
yeah.
Hey, you'll like this story, you know, this patient. And I, you know, then the walls would start to come down and we'd begin a dialogue. Uh-huh. I mean, years ago, I mean, we're talking like 30 or 35 years ago, I was on all the famous talk shows, mm-hmm. you know, Oprah and Phil Donahue and Sally Jesse, and I can't remember all the others. And they always had people there to argue with me.
Mm. Was that exhausting?
Phil Donahue. I mean, Phil Donahue I respected very much for one time we were there. But the others would always have people there to argue and, you know, make it an exciting show with a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. The audience is always on my side, but the doctors sitting around me weren't. But I'll tell you why I mentioned Phil Donahue. I went there with three women with cancer. Mm. And when we got there, you know, what am I used to? I get on the stage, you know. But Phil said, you'll sit in the audience. The three women will sit on the stage.
Wow.
I said to him, yes, you got it right. Because they're my teachers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
They taught me about potential. They taught me about survivor behavior. You know, so I would pass on the messages I learned from the people in our support group. Hmm. And generally it is the women who are into surviving, while the men are, I can't work, what's the point of living? You know, so it's helping the women live for themselves, not just, you know, for their kids or their husband. And get the men to see there's more to life than your work. Mm. You got a family sitting around you while you're telling me there's no point in living. I mean, I always say I don't make up these stories. You have a man sitting in front of you who says there's no point in living, I can't work anymore, and his wife and two children are sitting right next to him.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe he would say something like that. And I pointed out to him, I said, there are three good reasons in the room. Then it was like I hit him in the head with a mallet, you know? I mean, I think he woke up for the first time that there's more to life than working.
And, you know, there's another thing that hits me a lot, not with the mallet, but anyway. I've noticed, even in my work, which isn't maybe as profound as yours, but people are very often, people receive a healing when they're actually seen and known for who they are individually.
That's
and,
right.
And it shocks me sometimes. I go, we're so... That happens so rarely that it just jolts them in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I like to ask people, well, I'll ask you a test question.
Okay.
How would you introduce yourself to God when you get to heaven? And they say, you're next, you know, to be admitted to heaven. Hmm. How do you want to be introduced to God?
Golly. I'm kind of blank right now. I finally made it.
Come back when you know who you are.
Ah.
See, what I try to get across to people, what gets you in is saying, tell God his child is here. Or tell God, you know, God is here. It's you. And then they say, come on in. That you recognize your own divinity.
I love that. That's really
Oh, and
wonderful.
For your sense of humor, this really came from a high school student. It blew me away. Because most of them are so depressed, they, oy. But anyway, he said, tell God his replacement is here. And I thought that's a kid who has self-esteem and has got to be loved by his parents, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting because I was thinking when you asked me that question, how I've been really a Trojan as far as working and working and working and working toward it. So that's not assuming one is wonderful as we are, right?
Yeah, but you are divine. I mean...
Yes.
You know, you're made of the same thing. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. You come from God.
Such an interesting journey. So do you think more and more people are waking up in your field? Is your business bigger? Do you have more groups?
Oh, yeah. They're all over the place. I mean, I get... Well, in the last few days, I was asked to speak in Mexico and in Africa. So the message is traveling very much around the world. And especially, you know, with the internet, you can dialogue with people. And I said, I mean, I'm traveling less now because my wife needs some caregiving. And, you know, so if she doesn't travel with me, I don't like leaving home, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But I said maybe with Skype I could do it. And they were thrilled with that. So, you know, with the technology, you're talking and communicating with people all over the planet. I mean, I used to spend hours writing letters years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, in a few minutes, you can bounce up and back all around the planet with people.
And that can mean that we're kind of sending all over the world a healing feeling and a waking up, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Now, if you could tell people at home, like when you use the drawing, how do you set it up? Like, I'm not an artist, and how do you set it up so people know, like, do they just, on a cold piece of paper, you say, draw me a picture,
well,
period?
Well, I mean, part of the problem with adults is just what you said. I'm not an artist. You know, they're worried about doing it wrong.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
I have people who have their kids draw the picture for them. You know, when I'm trying to help them deal with a life-threatening illness and they're having a child draw the picture for them, I mean, it just gets insane. But, and the kids, I may add, they're not worried about, you know, about being judged as an artist. So they'll produce it very quickly and easily. But the basic material is a white piece of paper mm-hmm. and a full box of crayons. When I say full, I mean the rainbow plus black, white, and brown. Mm-hmm. So you have all the colors available.
Okay.
And then you use what feels right for you. So, you know, in essence, you cannot do it wrong. You know, it's like, again, if you have a dream, you don't say, oh, that was, you know, the wrong dream or a no good one. Mm-hmm. No, it's trying to help you. And mm-hmm. so the drawing also will reveal things and blind you to what you're drawing often.
Mm. So do you start a subject like you've got a sore something or another, a sore leg?
Well, yeah, if people have an illness, I will say draw yourself, your disease, your treatment and your immune system, okay. eliminating the illness.
Okay.
So I don't get into killing anything.
Okay.
See? And then they can interpret it in their own way. And it's not me telling them what to draw, but just those basic things. You could say, I don't know whether to take a new job. Draw the jobs you're thinking about.
Mm.
I had a doctor friend say he didn't know who to marry. I said, put all the women in a picture, you know, with yourself and send them to me. And we helped him have a happy marriage. It's choices, home and family. That I tell everybody. Give your kids a box of crayons. Tell them draw a picture of the home and family to hang on the refrigerator.
Okay.
Don't tell them you're going to use it to learn anything. Then after they're done, take a look at it. Does it look like a family?
Mm-hmm.
Are you together or are you all over the place?
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also you can see, as one woman drew of her childhood, the mother had two drinks on the tray, one for her father, one for her brother, nothing for her.
Oh.
And she's off under a cloud.
Oh.
So, you see, again, it's not me criticizing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like a family, I think this is in the book, where the child had cancer, said, I don't get enough time for my family. There were three siblings and the parents, so there's six people in the family, and I didn't want to spend a day asking them, what do you do all day?
Mm-hmm.
I said to her, draw me a picture. She shows herself sitting alone on a chair. The rest of the family is on the sofa, you know, hugging each other, with an empty seat on the sofa that she could be in, but
oh
she's not.
Oh.
And I said to the parents, look how she feels. And they were very thankful, you know. They have a child with cancer. They want to be good to her. This is a good group.
And they might have isolated her just because they're protecting her or something.
Yeah, who knows what was going on at home, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, not wanting to upset her or disturb her. I don't know what they're thinking, but...
Mm-hmm.
They went home and really focused more time on her and changed things and thanked me many times for the drawing.
So what about if somebody, I love that actually. So you're just saying draw in response to a question or a situation, right?
Yeah, or anything that comes up spontaneously, because I was just thinking of another one that's in there that my neighbor did. She was very depressed. You know, she came over to talk to me and was very depressed. I said, draw a picture, because there's past, present, and future in it. As Jung said, the future is unconsciously prepared long in advance, and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance.
Mm.
She drew the picture, and there are four parts to it. The upper right is the present. She was headed downhill with four rays of sunshine. She said, yeah, those are my four kids. I'm getting a divorce. In the near future... The lower right, there were eight people in red standing there. I said, what's that about? I don't know. In the past was like, you know, ocean waves. Oh, yeah, I grew up in a house on the beach. And the far future were a lot of black clouds. Well, that's my divorce, I guess. Several weeks after she drew the picture, she sent her kids to get on the school bus. And she took an overdose of sleeping pills to commit suicide.
Oh, my.
Here's another test question for you. What do you think the kids did when the school bus pulled up?
Do you think they knew already?
They went home and saved their life. They didn't get on the bus. And when she woke up in the intensive care unit, who's standing around her bed? Eight members of the family, mad as hell, at what she had done.
Wow. See?
And that's why, after the drawing, then it all makes sense, you see, because then she lived what she had drawn. And I have one drawing in there where a child symbolically draws the operating room she's never been in.
Ah.
The number of lights, black knobs on the lights, the color of the sheets on the table, the number of people taking care of her. It's all there. So, you know, I try to share those things.
I like the one with the guy who didn't know whether he should be a doctor because he thought...
He drew the three pictures. I'm a teacher, I'm a politician, I'm a doctor. And because his father had been a doctor who died of cancer, and it kind of scared him. See, maybe part of why my father got sick is what it's like being a doctor. But, you know, if you look at his pictures, it's obvious the doctor one is the healthiest, happiest one.
Yeah, it's lots of colors in it and so
on. Yeah, yeah. So and there's a door in the room, because I said to him, if it gets stressful, you step out the door. You take a vacation.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And actually, the other ones don't. Oh, one of them kind of has a door, but mostly they're kind of.
Yeah, the others, you know, I mean, he's not a whole person. Like when he's a teacher, the nice colors are outside the window.
Right, right.
You know, the room, nobody has hands or feet or ears or anything. Yeah.
Well, how many people, what do you think the percentage is? Like, for example, when they draw these pictures, does it illuminate within themselves some constriction or something that can release them? Do many people get healed by doing that?
Yes, because it's coming from within them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like turning a light on inside of yourself. You know, that when it gets interpreted, and as I always say, it's not me telling them what's in it. It's my suggesting things. And when it connects with them, you know, then it's like, yeah. So I try to help them discover what it means. You see, it's like if you drew yourself without ears,
mm-hmm.
we could say you don't want to listen to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could say, no, I'm deaf. So, again, I want the person there. Or one that had me laughing. This child came in. The whole picture he drew was black. Everything was black.
Oh, my.
And I thought, yeah, that's my feeling. Oh, my God, what's going on here? And he said, I have two older brothers. That's the only crayon they give me. You know, so again, you know, we can laugh. I can
But he wasn't depressed like that. I mean, he wasn't
That's right, yeah. See, if he had mailed it to me without any comments, I would have been worried and called his parents. And see, the boy who did come in asking me to operate on him because the kids were teasing him in the locker room about his body,
uh-huh.
I said, draw yourself in the operating room. Now, he only used a black crayon and looks like an insect on the operating table.
Oh, my.
See, that's when I'd say to his parents, look, I will fix, you know, what the kids are teasing him about, but he needs your love. Otherwise, he'll spend his life, you know, fixing himself, trying to be perfect, and it doesn't work. So he needs your love so he can feel good about himself and not worry about everybody's criticism.
Do you ever draw your own pictures, Bernie?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I think there are some in there about our family, too. See, that's also what impressed me, that for a while, I used to draw one every month just to look at what was going on in my life each month and how I was evolving. But I remember drawing our family once, you know, wanting everybody to know what a wonderful family and everything's fine and perfect. And one of the kids at the time I drew it was driving us nuts. And
kids have that way, right?
When we looked at the picture, we have five children. Mm. When I looked at the picture intellectually, you know, with everybody else, after I had drawn it, I realized he's not holding hands with his brother on either side. And I thought that was fascinating, because I had consciously intended to make sure we're all touching and, you know, embracing and look wonderful as a family. And here was the interruption.
Hmm.
And that's what impresses me about it.
So what did you do about that?
You. Well, oh, well, we knew what we were doing at home with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was getting a lot of time and attention, and we were working things out. See, there's a picture there that shows the resolution of it. When he was older, I'm trying to get him to go off to college.
Okay.
And he's doing all kinds of things. And then my wife drew a picture, a spontaneous one at a workshop. Everybody was drawing. She just picked up some crayons and drew. She drew five trees at the top, one of which is out of line. In other words, four in a straight line is one in front of them. Mm. And you know, that's that kid. He's out of line. At the bottom, he was home with the twins. So there were five at home and two were away at school. But at the bottom of the picture, my wife drew four flowers on the left and three flowers on the right side of the picture and six cattails between them. When I looked at that picture, I knew he had decided to leave, you see, because it's four and three, not the five and two anymore. Oh. 6 weeks from the day of that drawing, he left to join his brother in Denver and go to school there.
Wonder.
Now, the six, I knew meant something, but I didn't know it would be 6 days, 6 months, you know, or 6 years. But I knew that he had decided to leave, and I didn't have to, you know, be a pest anymore in the sense of trying him to get him to get out in the world.
So you don't need to say very much, I guess. Or did you interpret it for him?
No, I didn't tell him. Mm. I just saw it that my wife had done and knew the decision was made. So from then on, I'm just helping him make plans and do things, yeah.
Isn't that something, eh? So I'm going to try and do that, or not try. I'm going to do that.
Draw yeah, numbers are the way we store memories.
Okay.
See, one of the pictures, again, in the book, a reporter in her drawing of herself, she has a big head, and I knew she was intellectual, and I wanted to change the interview before we started, so I said, draw a picture while I finish with the patients in my office. When she came in handed to me, in order to shake her up, I didn't just say, why is 12 important to you? I said, because there was only one hand on the clock pointed at 12. I said, what happened when you were 12 years old? Well, I don't like deadlines. I said, what happened? And then she became tearful and told me what happened when she was 12 years old. See? Mm. Or 21 drops of blood. And the lady was sexually abused. A broken heart has 21 drops of blood under it. And she was sexually abused when she was 21 multiple times. You know, and those are things that are stored in people.
Hmm.
Because literally, again, our life, including our childhood, is stored in our bodies. And if we don't deal with those issues, because the lady with the broken heart and the 21 drops of blood, her doctor got in touch with me to say, we don't know what is going on. She's having all kinds of pelvic problems. Nobody can fix them. And could you help us? I said, tell her to draw a picture. And she spontaneously drew the broken heart and the 21 drops of blood. And then the story comes forth, and now they have something to work on, you know, to help her to heal her past and deal with it.
Did they get you to interpret it, or did they...
No, they sent it to me.
Oh, okay.
I just spontaneously, because it was emailed to me,
mm-hmm.
So I spontaneously said, ask her what happened when she was 21, because I counted the drops of blood.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the answer back about the disastrous year it was in her life.
Mm-hmm. So then when that happens, so somebody, it reveals itself in this drawing, does the person actually get the relief of, like, sexual abuse is a really big container for some people, isn't it?
But
does it release it?
It comes up. In other words, the fact that it comes up, now we can deal with it and talk about it. See?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's not buried with a lid on it. It's something that is now out and can be discussed, and, you know, various kinds of therapy can be brought into it.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just creating physical problems or emotional problems or isolation. Wow, isn't that exciting? So I love when you called it your Jungian toolbox.
Yeah.
Which is crayons and
I love the term that, I was a Jungian surgeon. But because even in the operating room, just talking to people under anesthesia, music, all these things. And as I say, one of the operating rooms even made a coloring book for the kids because they were so impressed by the drawings. It became a formal event. In other words, when children, because I did a lot of children's surgery, came to the operating room, they were handed a coloring book.
Hmm.
See? And then we knew about them and their families and everything else. And believe me, even on the front page, it says, the anesthesiologist is wearing an outfit that looks like green pajamas. And a child comes in and draws him in red.
Oh, really?
See? That child's mother had muscular dystrophy. He knew there were dangers from muscle relaxants for him. If he had a genetic problem also, he would have an adverse reaction to these muscle relaxants because they wouldn't relax. They would all become hyperactive and contract. And as the anesthesiologist said, if they all become active and contracting, it could raise body temperature and damage the brain.
Huh.
And when I saw, when he explained that to me, I said, look at the last page. If he draws himself purple, then we cancel the operation because that's a spiritual color. He could be saying, I'm going to be dead. You know, I'm dying in the operating room.
And was it purple?
No, fortunately. Mm-hmm. It was, he had himself, he wasn't wearing them, but he put on like a black shirt and red pants, and his leg was where we operated, so I knew the red was saying, my leg hurts, and the black shirt was, I'm not happy.
Aw, well, that's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what about when you're seeing that people are going to pass? I'm sure that there are some messages that come
through. Well, we help the families, yeah. See, a woman drew her husband flying a kite, a purple kite. And I said, it looks like you're ready to go, but your husband can't let go. So we brought him in.
Hmm.
And he said, yeah, my wife's a nurse. She takes care of everything. If she dies, I'm dead. I don't know how to, you know, make a meal, pay the bills, anything. She said, I won't die. I'll train you. See, and 4 months later, he said, honey, I cut the strings. If you need to go, it's okay.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I'll die Thursday when the kids get here from California.
Oh.
Now, that's the kind of thing, you see, that you can
that
help.
That makes me cry, actually. That's very wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah. Or a child named Amber. I have her drawing in my house because her mother gave it to me. Because Amber drew a purple balloon with her name in it with lots of colorful dots all around it and some decorations. And see, here again is the intuitive thing that's interesting. At the bottom of the page, she drew a child's face crying in green and yellow. Those are healthy colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this doesn't make sense. She's ready to go, and this healthy face. So I said something to her about that. She said, oh, that's not me. That's the kid in the next room crying.
Oh.
Now, that to me was fascinating.
Wow.
She changes her colors when she draws the kid in the next room.
Hmm.
And I said to the mother, take her home and love her because she's ready to go.
And did she pass?
Did.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call. And what the phone call was about was, Bernie, Amber woke up. It's my birthday today. She said, Mom, I'm dying today to free you from all the troubles.
Aww.
And what a gift that was.
Wow. And but could the mother receive
And I may
that?
Add, all the dots were the days left in her life.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So it helps the mother to receive it, to have it be so.
Yeah, the mother, I mean, it became, the child really became a teacher for the mother.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain that, but I mean, the mother wrote a book about what Amber taught her, and it just changed everything. As I said, even gave me the drawing to hang in my house because it meant so much to her.
Oh, I love that. There's a funny story here about a fellow who came to your group, the Exceptional Patient Group,
mm-hmm.
and he said, I just can't buy the whole package.
Yeah, that was Frank, yeah.
Yeah, and then, would you want to tell the story?
Starting,
I love that story.
When I was just starting it, One of my patients, I didn't know it, she was a mystic. Mm. I mean, I still refer people to her to talk to members of the family who have died. Mm. I mean, she's incredible. Mm. I mean, she doesn't know any of these people. She didn't know my family either. But when my parents died, she called me to tell me they're being shown around by somebody who likes cigarettes and chocolate. And that's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Aww.
Now, she doesn't know my parents. She doesn't know I knew Elizabeth. I mean, it's incredible, the calls. She was the one who told me, I've now written 13 books. The only C I got in college was in creative writing. If there's anything I never expected to do in my life is write a book. And Monica said to me, you're going to write books. Say, way ahead of time. She got me ready.
Did you roll your eyes and go, yeah, right?
Yeah, I said, that's the one thing, I'll, you know, it's not likely. But anyway, she came in the office one day years ago and said, Bernie, now that I know you're not normal, at our group last night, we asked for a message for Bernie, and this is what we got from Frank. If I'd known it was this easy, I'd have bought the package a long time ago and not have resisted so much. And I said, I know who that is. He had just died. He was a doctor in town, and I got to give him a lot of credit for coming to the group with his wife. So I called his wife. I said, I got a message from Frank. And I told her, and she said, oh, my God. I said, what's wrong? Am I upsetting you? No. That's what he would say every time he walked out of your meeting. I can't buy the package. And that's why when she would bring me messages with the name of the person, I knew who she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's not just some vague thing. I mean, she would call up and give me a name, and I would connect immediately with what she was saying.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you obviously believe in the ongoing journey of who we are, right?
Oh, yeah. I tell people to look. Mm-hmm. Look for signs, because it's incredible the things that happen. For me, a symbol has always been a penny. You know, like as the grandchildren said, when my mother died, pennies from heaven. I found 3 dozen pennies when my mother died.
Oh, wow. That's
it was
wonderful.
Absolutely unexplainable in the sense that I would go to get the mail in the morning. We have a long driveway. On the way back, I found pennies, not on the way there.
Wow.
And there is no way I could have missed them.
I love that.
I mean, and I just kept saving them and added up to about 3 dozen.
Isn't that amazing, eh?
And that's why the grandkids, great-grandkids started saying, oh, they're pennies from heaven. They didn't even know what I was feeling. But when they came up with that term, it's like, okay, I got it.
Yeah, I have relatives over in England, and they lost a child who was born at 9 months, and she died right in the birth canal for some reason. Nobody really knows why. But in any case, since then, they've all received white feathers at the strangest times, little white feathers, you know.
I mean, if you sit in a room of compassionate friends, you know, parents of children who have died, mm-hmm. once the door shuts, they tell the stories. Because they know they're safe then. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Nobody's going to say that's silly, that's crazy, that type of thing. And, I mean, I always remember one that pops in my head, that this woman's daughter was murdered.
Ooh.
She was fascinated by birds and very much into birds. And she was telling us that when the other daughter was just married, a bird, it was an outdoor wedding, landed in the tree and disrupted the whole wedding. It's loud cackling. Everybody said, oh, it's your daughter, it's your daughter. We have an open window in the meeting room. In the window, a bird flew while she was talking.
Oh, my, really?
And, you know, the thing I know is that no bird ever even flew into the window in all the years I'd been sitting there,
mm-hmm.
you know, or even landed on the windowsill. But to come in, and everybody in the room was like, hey, your daughter's here again. Mm. I mean, those things are just not coincidences, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's more to it than that.
Well, it seems like if we can read all the signs that are coming to us regularly, we really get more of ourselves, too, like your pictures that are drawn.
I mean, I had a patient go to die on the island of Kauai, one of the Hawaiian islands, to straighten out a relationship with her mother and die there with her mother, and she did. I show up there a year and a half later to give an outdoor workshop. And the night before the workshop, or the afternoon before, we were in a store, and there was a butterfly flying around, confused by the light. So we're always, our whole life, been rescuing animals. Won't get into the zoo we lived in.
That'd be an interesting other show, yeah.
My wife reached up her hand, and the butterfly landed on her hand.
Oh, my.
And came out of the store with us. And we're expecting it to fly off. Instead, it sits on my wife's shoulder, gets into the car, goes back to the apartment, and spends the evening sitting on my wife.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, her hand or shoulder just hopping around. We're ready to go to bed. I said, you got to get rid of the butterfly. You know, we can't get in bed with a butterfly. My wife went out on the porch, brushed it off her shoulder, came in, said, okay. I said, take a look at your other shoulder. The butterfly came back in the apartment on her other shoulder.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we stopped trying to get rid of it and got it to, you know, drink some sugar water. And when it jumped onto the dish to drink, we jumped into bed. Then I knew it was like one of us. So the next morning, I let it know we're going to use it at the workshop. When we got there, I put the butterfly in a bag. It had no problem, you know, jumps in. I close the bag. We go to the workshop. And I said to people, you know, I talked about the symbol of the butterfly as transformation. And I opened the bag and out flies the butterfly. And it spent the entire day flying over our head from 9 in the morning till 5 in the evening.
Oh, my.
When I announced that, you know, it's 5 o'clock and we're done now, the butterfly left.
Oh, wow. Isn't that impressive?
I have so many photographs. When I lecture, I always show a slide of the butterfly sitting on my wife's shoulder.
Wow.
I mean, it was just, there's no way, again, to explain that, except it's the spirit of the person I knew who went to the island and died there.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful? So our spirits can travel in any mode, right? I was going to say any living.
Well, there's no time. See, that's the other thing I had to learn. There was a concept I had a lot of difficulty with, because when parents would tell stories about their children who died, showing up 5 years later and saving their life, and I mean literally, giving them advice and telling them things, my comment would always be, your kid's a bum, hanging around for 5 years, could be in a new body doing something, back in school by now. And Brian Weiss, who is a student at Yale and has written books about past lives, it was always saying to me, Bernie, there's no time when you're out of your body.
Right.
I couldn't buy that, though. I mean, you know, how could it not be? But in the movie or the show, Carousel, it's fascinating.
Oh, that's an old one. I haven't seen that, I don't think.
The angel asks this fellow, do you want to go see your child graduate from high school? He says, what are you talking about? My daughter's a baby. I died when she's a baby. And the angel says, there's no time up here. See, that's when I accept the truth.
Wow.
Because the playwrights, the novelists, the poets, they see the world and know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that.
Mm-hmm. I
and
love
so
that.
So when I
yeah.
read it in one of those, you know, in a poem or in a play or a musical, I know. And so I immediately accepted it. There's no time when you leave your body.
Mm.
And so it's not 5 years later to your child, if you know what I mean,
because
the consciousness doesn't have time associated with it.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, isn't it? So there's no time and space, and we can visit each other on any level. What about, do you work with contracts and so on amongst souls, like completing things before people pass? Or
do I?
Mm-hmm.
I just try to help people do what they want to do. Let's put it that way. I like calling myself a life coach.
Yeah.
I just try to guide them and help them. And the other words I like are be a love warrior, that use love as your weapon in life. And it's a powerful weapon and will change people.
Wow. Well, I know that you're really waking a lot of people up to the power of the kinder things, of the love.
Yeah,
of the,
absolutely.
Of the personal love, actually, being able to love ourselves enough. Well, thank you, Bernie Siegel, Dr. Bernie Siegel, for your wonderful new book called The Art of Healing. And we just kind of touched on it, but it's a very exciting, I don't know, it's such an inspiring piece of work that you've done, this book.
Well, if it's in you, see, that's why I like the life coach term.
Mm-hmm.
When people tell me I'm inspiring, you know, and they see all these wonderful things in me, I say, no, it's in you. I'm just bringing it out. And that's what the coaches do. Because I also can have people come up and say, oh, I'm sorry I came to your lecture. You keep saying the same thing. It's so boring. And the next person in line is telling you how inspiring you are and how wonderful. You know, it, again, if we all go to the same movie, some of us like it, some of us don't. It's what's in you gets projected onto other people.
Right.
So I always look for people who have that within them, and I just work hard to bring it out.
I really love it, and you make it sort of easier to touch the deeper inner potential in me. That's what you do.
Well, thank you.
So I thank you so much for your work in the world, and people can get hold of you on your website?
Yeah, Bernie Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, BernieSiegelMD.com. They can communicate with me, read that article, Deceiving People into Health, Waging a War Against Cancer, which I don't believe in. As Mother Teresa said, I'll attend a peace rally, but not an anti-war rally. So it's helping people to put things together.
And you also accept questions from people.
Oh, yeah.
I like that.
The contact. Yeah.
I think that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us and for being a paradigm shifter.
Thank you.
All right. Good night. Wow, that was a wonderful, wonderful conversation with Dr. Bernie Siegel, who's been making a huge difference since the 70s, I believe, or the early 80s, and waking us up to the power of our own healing abilities. And we're all magical, and he's making sure we know it. His latest book, The Art of Healing. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening. You can check my site, veronicaentwistle.com, and there's an Ask Veronica button. You can even ask me a question or have set up a reading or whatever. Many blessings and good night.